short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. This week, Governor Phil Scott reappointed Kevin Mullen as the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board. That's the panel that oversees virtually all health care issues in Vermont. The board reviews hospital budgets, proposed rate increases from private insurance companies, and it develops strategies to make health care more affordable in Vermont. Has the board been successful in achieving its goals, and what are the major issues that it faces in the coming years? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Green Mountain Care Board Chairman Kevin Mullen. Kevin, great to have you back on the program.
Great to be here, Bob.
Kevin, you've been on the board now for about 15 months. In what areas do you think you have made the most progress in containing health care costs during this time period?
I would say that the board as a whole in that 15-month period has really honed in on affordability issues and trying to make healthcare more affordable. And the people that preceded me really set the stage for allowing us the ability to do that. And if you take a look at the last 3 years, we've had historically low increases in both rates and prices in the state of Vermont. So just to give you an example, we just recently wrapped up the review of insurance rates for the QHP plans, which are those plans that are sold on the exchange for the individual and small group markets. And I'm very proud of the work that we were able to do as far as reducing what the request was. And if you take a look at the dollar value of the reductions that the board was able to achieve, and of course, we're still have our fingers crossed because they're still subject to an appeal period. But as of now, we're not hearing anything about an appeal. And when you add the two decisions together, just for that individual and small group market, we're talking about roughly just under $19 million in savings to Vermonters.
If you look at the Blue Cross rate increase, it's somewhere in the high 5%. Is that about right?
So Blue Cross, this is where it gets tricky, Bob. So they came in and initially filed for a 7.5% increase that and here's where we get into the tricky part, that because of what happened by a decision made in Washington on cost-sharing reductions, Vermont took the step and passed legislation last year that basically creates reflective silver or silver-loading plans. And so what you'll see is at the end of the day, Vermonters will be able to receive higher advance premium tax credits when they go to the exchange. So that brings that down. So and then Blue Cross came in and did an amendment to what they filed. So after the amendment, they were seeking a 9.6% increase, and we lowered that to 5.8%. But because of what the Vermont legislature and the governor did with the law regarding reflective silver plans, the actual rate felt by Vermonters from Blue Cross Blue Shield is 3.2%. And the same is true of MVP. They came in with a rate request of 10.9%. We brought that down to 6.6%, but because of the legislation, that ends up being a 1.9% increase on average for Vermonters. And again, the key word is on average, because some Vermonters will see less of an increase and some Vermonters will see more of an increase.
That 5.8% for Blue Cross, though, I understand their folks are eligible for higher tax credit subsidies, then that reduces that rate. Nonetheless, 5.8%, is that sustainable?
Oh, it definitely is not sustainable. That's what you know, is the heart of what everything that we're doing. And it gets to what we're doing as far as trying to move people away from a failed model of fee-for-service, where there's defensive medicine, where there's unnecessary treatment. And we're trying to move people through an agreement that was signed with the federal government, that was signed by my predecessor at the board, the former governor, and the head of AHS, that basically tries to move us to a new world of medicine where it's population health, value-based medicine with a focus on prevention and wellness, keeping people healthier, better coordination of care so you're not seeing hospital readmissions and the like. So that's where we're hoping to take the system in Vermont. We don't know if we'll be successful, but I think everybody is working very hard towards the goal of trying to create a new world in medicine. And, you know, we just finished our first half of our hospital budget hearings this week. And I mentioned to the CFO for the UVM network that wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if, rather than somebody coming in and saying our revenues are down, that we had somebody come in and say our revenues are down, we had a great year because we kept our population healthier and they didn't require the amount of services that we had planned on, and so we made reductions accordingly in our expenses. And that's what we're trying to move towards.
And I want to talk to you about that system a little later in the program so that listeners can understand, have a better idea of how it's going to work. You were mentioning some areas where you think the board has made some solid progress in keeping healthcare more affordable. What's an area that you look at and you just can't get this thing under control?
So there's a few areas that are really troublesome, and one that we really can't control, but we see that it's continuing to push rates up, and that is prescription drugs. And we know that there are some things that can be done. They need to be done in Washington, and we keep sending the message out, please, please do these things. We know that, for example, the National Institutes of Health are paying for half of the research and development for new medications. And yet the other half of the costs on research and development are amortized mainly in the U.S. market rather than across the whole world. So you might as well say the United States is paying for the research and development for the entire world, and that's just not right. The other thing that is always troublesome to me in particular is when I turn on the television and see ads for medications. And I think there's only a couple countries in the world that allow for that type of media assault on the consumer to try to increase demand for medications. We have a system that allows for some loopholes to keep brand name drugs from going to generic quicker. These are all things that could be changed in Washington if they had the desire to do it. And what's frustrating is if you talk to anyone that's running for Congress or anyone running for president, they're all saying the right things. It's just when they get there, they don't seem to accomplish the right things on that. The other thing that's been especially frustrating for me is the ability for the insurers, and I understand their position, but it creates and what I'm talking about here is for us to know exactly what the rate of reimbursement is to a hospital for, you know, pick anything. Say you pick an endoscopy, a colonoscopy, let's say that. We don't get to see the variations between the hospitals for the reimbursement by the insurers because they consider it to be a market secret that would jeopardize their competitive abilities with their competitors if they released it. What we get to see is the charge master sheet for the hospitals, and that's not what is being paid. Some hospitals negotiate discounts off of the charges. Some are on fee schedules, and it's frustrating not to be able to know. So, for example, in this year's initial hospital budgets that were submitted on July 2nd, there's a range of price increase on rates that ranges between 2% at Northwestern and 7.9% at Copley. But we don't know, for example, if Northwestern is below or above Copley in certain reimbursements that are coming back from the insurers. So that's been very frustrating for me. You know, I have a few ideas that are still in the early stages that have not been readily received by people yet, but I'm still working on those. I haven't given up on how we might be able to do it in a way that wouldn't require a staff of 120 to set in each individual rate. And I think it can be done, and I'm going to continue to push forward on that.
It sounds like you think it was a mistake to allow these pharmaceutical companies to advertise on television.
I do.
You know, the companies would say, we're providing educational information to our consumers.
And I would say that we should have a system where everybody has a primary care provider, and they are seeking out counsel from their primary care provider over what is best for them, rather than a commercial on television that's a 30-second blurb that doesn't really give you the information that you need to make an informed decision as a patient.
And do you think those TV ads are driving up demand and that consumers are going to their doctor saying, hey, I need this?
I do.
Let's talk to Michael, who is calling from Ashford, Connecticut. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. And this is addressed to Kevin Mullen. I'm from Connecticut. I work in the insurance industry as a computer person, but I wonder if it's entirely straightforward to talk about tax credits as diminishing hikes when so many people really don't use tax credits. If they're working class or middle income filers, they're typically not going with a long form. And so doesn't the burden fall upon poor policyholders to really suck up these rate rises?
So no, Mike, the way it's set up with the Vermont exchange is that this is not on your tax return. This is information that you're entering when you're figuring out which metal level plan that you want that's sold on the exchange. So we're not talking about a traditional tax credit that you would see on a tax return. You're talking about a premium tax credit that goes to reduce your payments for your cost of insurance on the exchange.
Michael, thanks very much for your call today. Let's talk to Rolf in Brattleboro. Hi, Rolf. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Oh, great. Okay. So I like some of my friends I talk to experienced the current program in Vermont both as wonderful and terrible. And by that, I mean I broke both my arms last year, and so we managed to avoid almost a financial catastrophe because we did have a silver plan. We were able to afford a silver plan, which was new for us. Previously, we'd been on bronze, and this was a lot better. But we're in that funny category where we still end up, because we don't have the money to pay what comes, all the things that aren't actually covered from that experience. And also we receive tons of charitable care from the hospital because they deemed us to be eligible for it. We still end up having to charge, huge sums on a credit card in order to pay all the things that aren't covered. So that's one problem. And then the second problem is that I just received opportunities to work more and make more money and found out that because we'll be bumping up into another tier and because we're doing this opportunity came, 8 months into the year when we were assessed at a lower level of income because we were making less. If I take all those opportunities, I'll lose half of that income right off the bat and may have to pay even more back at the end of the year when we do our taxes. And so it's a huge disincentive to take on more work when we can't even tell without talking to a tax expert how much more we'll have to pay back in addition to losing about 50% of the potential income that I was going to make.
Rolf, thank you very much for your phone call. Kevin, this has got to be happening to a lot of people who, during the course of the year, as Rolf mentioned, end up working for more compensation, and then they immediately find out that all of a sudden their health insurance is going to get bumped up as well.
So this is a huge problem that goes well beyond health insurance in that and it's something that the legislature and the administration have talked about trying to find solutions for. And the benefit cliff, it's – you can talk about anything from the earned income tax credit to health care to what have you. There are definitely points in someone's earning potential that place them at a real disadvantage for the additional dollars that they make. And those are going to have to be addressed by the legislature. Obviously, the good news is that Rolf's had the ability to make some more money. The bad news is that he's not going to see a large benefit because he's making more money. And we need to create the incentives in the system so that people aren't hurt when they make more and work harder.
Kevin, I wanted to go back to this idea of transparency and pricing at hospitals. And tell me if I've got this straight. Let's say I need a knee replacement. If I went to the hospital in central Vermont, it might cost X. If I go to Burlington, it might be Y. If I go to Rutland, it might be Z. And let's make it even more complicated because those numbers will change depending on what insurance carrier I have. If I have Blue Cross, they might have a special price with Rutland. If I have MVP, it might be a different price with Central Vermont. And so do I have that straight?
So you do, and basically both Blue Cross and MVP have done a very good job creating websites for their particular subscribers to be able to go on and see that information. But at the end of the day, you as a patient, all you really care about for the most part, there's a very small minority that will do that price comparison. But for the most part, what the majority of consumers are looking for is what it costs them out of pocket, so their co-pays and deductibles, and then they're looking at quality and they're looking at convenience. So naturally you would want to go to your hometown hospital if they have good quality because that's the most convenient for you. But if your hometown hospital doesn't have as good as quality, you may go elsewhere. It's a very rare individual that will make their decision based on what the actual price is. And so for the people who have Blue Cross and MVP, they have those web-based tools that they could do that on. Say you're an individual that doesn't have insurance, you would have to look at the charge masters for the different hospitals and literally call around and try to get that information. And the charge master and what the insurance company pays are completely different.
And if you're a person who has no insurance, most likely you're going to pay the highest price.
If you could afford to pay it. In most cases, what ends up happening if you're a person with no insurance, you probably don't have the ability to pay. And every hospital is required to provide the care whether you can pay or not. So you're going to show up. You're going to – if you need an emergency appendectomy, that procedure is going to be done for you. And you'll end up on either free care or bad debt. And that's just the reality. And that's why we try to get as many people insured as possible because the rest of us – end up having to pay if someone goes in and can't pay their bill at the hospital. So it adds to the cost shift. What we have in Vermont is roughly 40% of all dollars paid for commercial insurance are higher than what the actual cost is, and that's making up for the free care. It's making up for governments paying less than the actual cost on certain procedures and items like that. So it would be a great place if everybody was able to pay and everybody was able to pay cost, we'd see a 40% reduction in commercial insurance rates. But that's not going to happen anytime soon.
And you're talking about the cost shift there, and it's really government agencies that are largely responsible for most of that cost shift. I went to your website, which has a lot of very valuable information on it, and based on the 2016 numbers, the cost shift from Medicare was $200 million, and from Medicaid it was almost that amount. Free care was $20 million, a lot of money, but not $200 million. And bad debt accounted for about $40 million. So as you're saying, you've got almost $500 million being transferred to private health insurance people to pay for the fact that government is not paying its fair share. Is that fair?
It is fair.
And government doesn't want to pay its fair share because that would probably require a tax increase.
That is correct.
You've been in the legislature. You've seen this cost shift just mushroom over the last 10 or 15 years. At some point, does it have to be dealt with?
It does have to be dealt with. And I you're bringing back memories of my I believe it was my first term in the House. And at the time, the state was actually flush with a surplus. And Howard Dean was governor. And we weren't making any progress in the committees to try to do something on the cost shift. So we floated an amendment on the floor that would have required Medicaid to go up by 10% each year until it was paying the same as Medicare. So we were just trying to bring it on par with Medicare. This was probably about 18 years ago now. And Governor Dean called us boneheads at the time. And I remember there was a representative from Williston, I believe, who went out and had buttons made that said boneheads for healthcare. And but the progress has not been made. And I think that many of my former colleagues in the legislature believe that until costs are brought under control, that it doesn't make a lot of sense to try to just throw money at the problem. And they're afraid that the problem is just going to continue to grow until we have a better system for healthcare. And that better system that we're attempting, and again, we may or may not be successful in this attempt, is the all-payer model.
So I want to be clear and understand what you said, the impact of the cost shift. 40%, if there was no cost shift whatsoever, and if Medicare and Medicaid were paying their fair share, you could reduce health insurance premiums by almost 40%?
Yes.
That's staggering.
Yep.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Marty, who is calling from Fairhaven. Hi, Marty. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good afternoon. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Marty.
I practice pharmacy in central Vermont, community pharmacy. And one of the things that strikes me in the last 2 years that is such a waste for our healthcare system, such a big waste of dollars and time and effort, is that none of our software systems talk to each other. So information still has to be gathered by phone calls, by telephone, by fax, in face-to-face meetings because, again, our software doesn't have an easy way of communicating. I can't communicate easily with the hospital, vice versa, and nursing homes, visiting nurses. That's my two cents.
Okay, Marty, thanks very much for your phone call. Wasn't the whole idea to have electronics in healthcare so, as Marty was saying, you could have these interactions between all these groups? And why hasn't it turned out that way?
So It's been very frustrating for everyone involved to see the progress or lack thereof that we've made over the years on our technology front. There have been a number of what I would call barriers to success that we're hopeful can be addressed. One of the initial barriers is in there. We're talking about a lot of different things when we're talking about information technology. We're talking about electronic health records, but we're also talking about the infrastructure as far as running practices, running hospitals, everything else. So when Vital first started, it was a backroom operation at VOS here in Montpelier.
And Vital is?
Vermont Information Technology Leaders. And I can remember I was in the Senate at the time, and they wanted the state of Vermont to make an investment of $1 million to try to help us start to move forward. And at the time, I remember we called in experts from IDX and other companies to try to help us analyze, and we ended up hiring a consultant from Washington, D.C., to help us with this, and we actually thought that we were going to get a 300% return from our investment. And I can tell you, if we had just gotten a 3% return from our investment, we would be very happy today. But it became clear that that $1 million wasn't going to be enough, and the rollout of Vital was much slower than what we had hoped for. There's a couple impediments to the success, I think, that I hope that we as a state can address. One is our consent policy. We have an opt-in consent policy where other states either have a modified opt-in, opt-out, or they have an opt-out, or they have a no consent policy. And we're going to have to make changes there if we're really going to be successful so that more information is available to be part of an exchange. We also have a problem in that a number of us back when this was being rolled out said, why don't we just insist that this is the program that people will use? And, of course, the federal government had a very firm policy that you couldn't do that, that it was an antitrust violation, and that you could insist upon communications ability but not one specific software platform. And so different practices and different hospitals over the years have bought different software applications, and it has been a nightmare. And if you talk to docs out in the field, they'll tell you that it's a lot easier to make a call and have somebody fax over the results of a previous test than it is to open up three different software programs and have all their screens running to try to figure it out. It's 6 minutes instead of 15 minutes. And these are the type of things that we really have to move forward on. And the state hired a consulting firm to do an analysis of where Vital was at, where we're at as a state. There have been a number of recommendations that have come forward. Vital has a new leader in Mike Smith who is very targeted in his short-term mission that he has there as the interim president to try to make some changes that are going to be meaningful for the state. And one of the things that we've tried to really stress in the all-payer model is this is a coalition of the willing, and the only way it's going to be a coalition of the willing is if accountable care organizations, and in our particular case in Vermont, we still just have one, which is OneCare. OneCare has to be successful at reducing the administrative burden that a doctor has when they're practicing medicine, so they can spend time with the patient rather than going to three different computer applications. And so I would say that Marty's right that the state has failed. Other states are in a similar boat. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense how in a world where we can do so many things online and have so much information available to us that this hasn't been able to be figured out. And I'm hopeful that Mike and his colleagues at Vital can make some meaningful step forwards, and even more hopeful that Todd Moore and his colleagues at OneCare can try to figure out a way that doctors can practice in a way that time is being spent with the patient and working on the patient's wellness rather than really spending a lot of time clicking keys on a keyboard.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Kate, who's calling from Bennington. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'm calling to express concern over the complications of the whole insurance company. I've been listening to it, and it's amazing how many more things come up when I hear all of this discussion. But initially, my concern is that insurance companies, you know, are kind of, it seems to those of us who are in the process of considering insurance, they're kind of running the show, and it's just much too complicated. We shouldn't have to choose between platinum and gold and bronze and all these different plans for insurance. I think there should be one system that pays for a single-payer healthcare system. I'm in support of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All idea, and I think that we need something that everybody can go to and know that they're going to get equal access, and hospitals know that they're going to get sufficient payment, and everything should be looked at from that point of view rather than ACOs and other organizations that really just provide another, in my opinion, level of administration to this whole process. And even though they're trying to keep down the costs, it could result in, you know, somehow healthcare rationing, you know, if what we're trying to do is give doctors incentives not to provide care, because that's part of this, you know, give them a little extra if they don't have to do as much for a particular patient. You know, that's, in my opinion, defeating the system, and it's really working against the individual people. I'm a recently retired teacher, so now I have not had to use my Medicare or my supplemental insurance that I have through the Vermont State Employees Association. But when I do, I'm not sure how it's going to work. It's just much too complicated. That's my opinion. Thank you.
Kate, thank you very much for your phone call. A lot of people are in Kate's position saying, you know, as we've just been discussing today on many issues, this is very, very complicated stuff. Do you think if we were having this conversation 10 years from now, it would be based much more on a Medicare for All model?
Well, so I would both agree and disagree with Kate's analysis in that I think that the system that we have has too many different bureaucratic layers, and I think it would be possible to have a Medicare for All system, and that would have to be done at the federal level. It could not be done at the state level, I don't believe. And the reality of that, though, is that that Medicare for All system creates the same types of fears that Kate expressed about the current system, in that whether or not you're going to get full coverage for different things. If you take a look at what the mandated coverage is in the state of Vermont, it's a much healthier coverage than what people are getting in most other states. And it's a very frustrating system. It's very frustrating to realize that we're spending almost one out of every $5 on healthcare in the state. And that's why we're committed to the work that we do to try to bring those costs down. I do want to say that Kate has made an argument that I've heard repeatedly from a number of people about the Accountable Care Organization may be just another added layer of cost and bureaucracy to the system. And that's one of the things that we have to certify each year, that the costs of operating OneCare are less than the savings that are achieved. And if that's not the case, then we should give up on this pilot project and walk away. But I don't see another option available to an individual state at this time. And I do think that the type of progress that we are making with our Accountable Care Organization is going to be meaningful. And when you take a look at hospital readmission rates, if you have a better coordination of care when somebody is released from a hospital and they're immediately getting services from a visiting nurse at home and making sure that things are being done properly, that person won't end back up in that highest cost possible setting, which is the hospital. And those are the type of strategies that we're focused on. And I agree that it does often seem to be much more complicated than it should be. But on the same token, I'm not so sure that I would have complete faith in a government-run system not making choices that might be even more harmful to Vermonters.
Kevin, based on the information at your website, there are at least 50 healthcare officials, administrators, and physicians who make more than $400,000 a year. And of course, at the UVM Medical Center, the president, John Brumstead's compensation package of $2 million has drawn a lot of attention, particularly by the nurses up there who are trying to get a wage increase. We got this comment from Ken Liebertoff, who for more than 30 years was the executive director of the Vermont Association for Mental Health, who wrote us, "In a strange and somewhat perverse way, the UVM board's cavalier behavior on administrative salaries has greatly undermined so much that is good within the hospital system. Quality care, dedicated staff, and a high level of performance are recognized and applauded. Clearly, many hospital administrators are smart, competent, and hardworking professionals, but their gold elite pay status make them the target for criticism and even ridicule, and there's tangible evidence that within the broader hospital community, physicians, nurses, and other employees feel demeaned, denigrated, and disheartened over the disparity in pay." What are your thoughts about executive pay?
So I knew it wouldn't be a short or an easy question if it came from Ken. But I think that what Ken's question has summed up is why I believe that we're in the position that we're in now, in that when you talk to board members, they make it quite clear that they have used a system for compensation that looks at peer hospitals around the country, and they try to look at that 50th percentile range. And so it's not that they can't justify it. It's just that it's very hard for Vermonters to and it doesn't matter what field you're in. If you're in Vermont, you're probably making less than your peers elsewhere. And, you know, you're coming to a state that has a great quality of life, but not the highest earning potential. So, you know, you can analyze any number of different fields, and the reality is that in a vast majority of fields outside of healthcare, that people working in those fields in Vermont are making less than their peers elsewhere. So, you know, I think the board has used a framework that they can justify, but on the same token, it's also a framework that is not really easily or even acceptable to Vermonters in general. When they see high-level executives making so much more than really what most people see as the heart of the healthcare system, and that's our nurses. And so it creates that tension. And I've got to tell you that I think the leadership team at UVM is one of the better leadership teams at an academic medical center in the country. But I think as an organization, there is some self-awareness that seems to be missing about what the public sees as the message. And so that is very, very frustrating to individuals. And, you know, I think that the board has tried to make very good decisions. Do I think I would have made the same decisions? It's hard to say from the outside looking in, but I do think that there is a real self-awareness problem, and that it's going to take a lot of time to heal the divide in the community. I've talked with Tom D down at Southwestern in Bennington, and Tom comes to our state from having worked in the Hudson Valley region of New York, and he told me the story of a hospital in the Hudson Valley region where it took literally a full decade to heal the wounds that were caused by a protracted impasse in negotiations. And I'm hopeful that we can get past that here in Vermont. We at the board would like to see nurses paid a wage that is fair and competitive, but also a wage that doesn't really drive up the costs of healthcare in the state. And I do worry about what I'm seeing as tremendous wage inflation in healthcare that is occurring. And you've seen a number of hospitals in the state over the past year having to make increases in compensation for people doing the frontline work. And that's going to continue. And that's one of the greatest pressures that we're going to face in Vermont on the cost of care is wages. And, you know, Ken brings up some great points. And, you know, it's easy from an outsider looking in to say, well, why don't they just have a policy where people making over X amount of dollars a year take a year off from getting any increase in pay? And if I was on that board, I probably would be making that recommendation to the board. Let's take some time off. We saw that in state government when we hit a real impasse, or not an impasse, but really a real problem in the budget numbers, where you know, revenues had gone way down, and everyone in state government that was making over a certain dollar threshold was asked to take a time out, basically, and not get an increase. And some people got a 5% pay cut. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that's what should happen in this particular case, but I think a gesture like that would go a long way, Bob, to trying to remind everybody that we're all working on a common mission. And the mission is to make sure that people have good health care, that they're treated well, that they're able to live a healthy lifestyle. And if, God forbid, an accident happens, that the medical care is there for them. So, you know, again, I'm very hopeful that the two sides can reach an agreement. If not, this could turn into much more of a worse situation than we already see now.
Well, that's all the time we have for our program today, taking a look at some of the key healthcare issues facing the state of Vermont. Kevin, we're going to have to get you back on. A lot of issues that we haven't had a chance to touch base on, so we'd like to get you back in the near future.
That'd be great, Bob.